Transmitter device activated. Coordinates set for Earth 2.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Earth 2 podcast, your weekly exploration of the DC Comics multiverse and the legacy of their Golden Age characters through the Silver and the Bronze Ages of comics. I'm Peter Watson.
I'm Brandon Peters.
I'm Christine Panton.
I'm Steve Higgins.
I'm Rich Fulham.
I'm Logan McFarlane.
I'm Ross Aiken.
I'm the Irredeemable Shag.
I'm Gavin Reza.
This is Chuck Lordens.
I'm Max Traver.
I'm Caitlin Higgins.
And I'm David Steele. Welcome back. Thank you for joining us. Welcome back, everyone else. Shag, if you move over a bit, Max will be able to sit down. Right. Listeners, you may have guessed we have a multicast epic going on. Yes, we're doing issue 113 of the Justice League of America, the 1974 Justice League of America, Justice Society team up. And as usual, making so much more work for ourselves, so much more work for Peter.
Sorry, Peter. Yes, thank you very much.
Yes, it's a good one, this. I've been anticipating this one for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. Because at this point, obviously, Justice League of America is a 100-page title. It's bi-monthly, so the first time the JLA-JSA story, I think maybe the only time, actually. It's a one and done.
It is, yes. Gasp.
It's not a two-parter or a three-parter or anything.
Indeed.
Maybe we'll speculate later on what they could have done if it had been a two-parter. Anyway, Peter is going to now tell us about the cover to this very important issue.
We have at the top the DC 100 pages for only 60 cents banner. Justice League of America underneath that, here come TV Super Friends. And the Comic Code Authority stamp is there as well. There's also a caption flash saying three full-length novels. The first one is a new JLA-JSA shocker. Can you guess the identity of the creature in the velvet cage? And we see Jay Garrick Flash, Batman of Earth 1 and Superman of Earth 1, being exploded back by a big giant sand creature who's come out of the ground. He's grasping Wonder Woman in his hand. My goodness, what a threat this is going to be.
It looks almost like a veritable Sandman in the Marvel Comics style, doesn't it?
It does indeed, yes. Very much a Spider-Man 3 looking character.
Yes.
Yes. Also in this issue, we have the Justice Society of America in the case of the patriotic crimes. Yep, more JSA action for you here. And in the panel that represents that, we have Alan Scott, Green Lantern. We have Hawkman, Black Canary, and Dr. Midnight. All springing into action as a big giant hand is holding what appears to be the Capitol building in Washington. The Washington Monument. Is that the Liberty Bell?
I think it is, yes.
Yes, some other bits and pieces
Looks like a train of some description. One of our American friends. We should ask someone while they're here.
We should. Steve. Anyone? Anyone?
Do you know what this train could be, Steve?
And the third story in this issue, the caption says, the Justice League trapped in the cavern of deadly spheres.
Those spheres do look deadly.
They do look deadly, yes. Did we cover that story? We mentioned it, I believe.
We did.
I think that's the one with the character that then appears in Crisis.
We did that episode very near the start when we did JLA issues. Was it 14 and 15 we talked about?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And there was one that we did quite closely. It was our first attempt at remote recording and the sound was terrible. And you didn't like the story, but I really did. And then we talked vaguely about another one because it involved some other dimensional, I think, was it that? I can't remember. I can't remember.
Listeners, go back and listen and tell us.
Because we recorded it probably 4.5 years ago, so stop shouting at us. Oh, wait a minute, there's another caption at the bottom which might give us an indicator of what was going on in that other panel.
Extra, the story of the Freedom Train, plus other fabulous features.
I wonder if it's the Freedom Train then that hand was grasping.
I think it's the Love Train. People all over the world should join hands and join the Love Train.
Stoke it up. Ooh, ooh.
The Love Train.
Yes. Mm. Bit of Holly Johnson for you there, listeners. This was the Power of Three. We'd probably hassle Kane into playing out with that. My favourite thing in this cover is the Partick Thistle stroke Our Man colours for the Just League of America logo.
Yes, that would strike a chord with you, yes.
Brilliant. So yes, issue 113 of JLA, published on the 4th of June 1974, just a few days, fact fans, before the final episode of John Pertwee's final Doctor Who story, The Planet of the Spiders.
Gasp.
And a whole 2 weeks before Paul McCartney's 32nd birthday. Make sure you check what I say next week when I tell you how far away from Paul McCartney's birthday issue 435 of Adventure Comics was published on. So yes, our cast has reassembled. A couple of folk are taking the weight off me, actually, because a couple of characters in this one who I'd normally voice, but a couple of folk are doing that for me, which is nice. It lets me just concentrate on telling the story. We're going to jump straight in.
Presenting the very latest all-new, all-star adventure of the Justice League of America. also featuring the legendary Justice Society of America.
And it's a very dynamic opening splash panel. There's a fight going on between some members of the JLA and the JSA in the middle of an art museum, by the looks of things. There's a nice big, weird pink and yellow splashy painting on the wall. We can see a statue of... Who do we think this statue looks like in the book? It's Donald Sutherland!
There you are.
Hi, I'm Donald Sutherland, and when I'm not doing acting, I enjoy listening to the Earth 2 podcast. And the assembled heroes, and I'll get to them in a second, are all battling these guys. Basically, they look a bit like... I want to call them owl men.
Yes.
They're wearing tight-fitting black uniforms with yellow boots and gloves and sort of leotard bits, but they also have little horned owl masks which blend into a sort of feathered area across their shoulders. There's about six or seven of them. You can see Superman throwing one of them into a baseball mitt that Green Lantern has conjured up. We can see Our Man punching one that Batman has sent flying towards him. Elongated Man is stretching up and around towards another one. Wonder Woman is lassoing one. Sandman is shooting one with his gun. And Jay Garrick is running circles around a couple of other ones, making him look very dizzy. So yes, to recap, hero-wise, we have Superman, Hal Jordan, Green Lantern, Ralph Dibny, the Elongated Man, Our Man, Wonder Woman of Earth 2, Batman of Earth 1, the Golden Age Sandman, the Golden Age Flash. You'll see this on the socials, obviously. Another bit of captioning rounds out the page.
No, reader, you're not late. Contrary to this brawling scene in a museum, the action has hardly begun. Cause what you're seeing now ain't nothing compared to the chaos that is going to break loose when the greatest heroes of two worlds confront
the creature in the velvet cage. And we're told that the story is brought to us by
Len Wein, writer, Dick Dillon and Dick Giordano, artists, Julius Schwartz, editor, The Fabulous Dicks, excellent.
Right, the caption for the first panel on page 2.
The battle is a short one, and when it is done...
Yep, we can see Green Lantern wrapping a few of the bad guys together, a few of the owl men, if you like, and Our Man comments...
Glad you guys decided to pay us a visit, Green Lantern.
And Hal says...
Not so certain I am, Our Man. We get enough of punks like the Horned Owl Gang on our own Earth.
The Horned Owl Gang, that's who they are, listeners. Wowza. Wonder Woman, we can see she's got a few of them wrapped up in a lasso. She says to Batman...
Speaking of your Earth, Batman, I hear my counterpart there has regained her superpowers. Why didn't you bring her along?
The Cape Crusader replies...
Because for reasons of her own, she hasn't rejoined the JLA yet, Wonder Woman. But that's another story.
And a little asterisk takes us to a caption which reads...
A story revealed in detail in Wonder Woman's own mag.
Yes, hearing this caption, Elongated Man, pointing at a couple of horned owl guys in this panel 3, says...
Then why don't we go someplace and listen to it over coffee or something? The police will be here any second to take care of the garbage.
To which the Flash says...
Sounds fine to me, Elongated Man.
In the next panel, the heroes take their leave from the museum. A caption tells us...
Dawn is breaking behind the York City Museum as the heroes of two worlds stroll out into the crisp spring air.
Beautifully rendered sunrise. As they're marching down the steps, Elongated Man is saying,
Man, did that little scrabble give me an appetite for...
But he's interrupted by a bweep, 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 bweep car alarm type sound effect, which is coming from a fancy looking red sports car that's at the foot of the stairs outside the museum. This prompts Batman to say,
That sound, what is it?
And then the Sandman rushes down the stairs, leaping into the car, saying,
No! After all these years, it couldn't have happened. It couldn't!
J-Flash runs after him, saying,
Sandman, what is it? What's wrong?
But the Scarlet Speedster's only response is the dwindling roar of a powerful engine.
Yes, the car roars off, indeed. Elongated Man cries,
Sandman, come back! Come on, nuts!
Batman says,
What's the matter with him? Why did he rush off like that?
Your guess is as good as mine, Batman. The only way we'll find out for certain is... follow him.
Across the cluttered streets of the city they speed, the fastest man alive at the vanguard. Until at last, before a plush townhouse on the Upper West Side, they halt, and...
After panel one, which shows Green Lantern bearing some of the heroes aloft, including Our Man, Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, and Elongated Man, why is he carrying Superman?
I don't know.
J-Flash is running along ahead, but yes, they arrive outside this fancy apartment building. Our Man's at the top of the stairs, he says,
He must have stashed the sand car someplace, but this is where he came, all right.
Then the Flash says,
Not surprising, I guess. Good thing nobody's awake to see us enter.
Moments later, inside...
Yes, we see Our Man standing in front of a massive bookcase. In front of him was, appropriately enough, I think, a massive, huge hourglass. Rex takes a book from the second shelf down, saying,
He told me about this trick hourglass once. Move the right book and it slides back to reveal a staircase leading to a secret sub-basement.
And sure enough, as Rex does this, the giant hourglass slides to one side, opening up a hole in the ground, and we can see steps leading downwards. And the next panel, the heroes make their way down the steps. Our man continues, saying,
"And beneath the plush townhouse of Playboy Wesley Dodds, we find the hidden headquarters of the Sandman."
Elongated Man is stretching his neck out in front of everyone else, and he says,
"But great gallop and goosebumps, take a look at it! This place looks like a cyclone hit it, then came back to make sure it had done the job right!"
Yes, what we see is furniture and desk drawers and stuff tipped up all over the floor. There's a massive glass chamber, that's the only way I can put it, listeners, which inside we can see has a bed and what looks like a tray that might have had some food on it, and there's a massive crack in the side of this glass chamber. Standing in front of it with his trademark fedora and gas mask removed and looking very, very handsome when you're used to the Guy Davis model is Wesley Dodds the Sandman, looking very, very downhearted. Wonder Woman says in response to Elongated Man,
"From the expression on the Sandman's face, I don't think this is a joking matter, Elongated Man."
In the first panel of page 4, we see Batman examining the jagged edge of the hole that's appeared in this glass chamber, and he says,
"This chamber was shattered from the inside, quite probably by whatever laid waste to the rest of this place."
Behind him, Wesley Dodds says,
"Not whatever, Batman. Whoever. I've kept this secret for too many years. Thank God I could finally tell someone. The creature who escaped from that cage was Sandy, the boy who was once my partner."
The heroes look astonished, none more so than G. Garrick the Flash, who says,
"Wes, what are you talking about? Sandy Hawkins left York City years ago."
"No, Flash. That's only the story I told everyone. The truth is, well, the truth is this."
We get a few rippled flashbacks over the next page or so, as a disembodied Wesley head narrates,
"I met Sandy shortly after I'd donned my new costume, an orphan who'd made an outfit emulate mine. He helped me out of a tight spot."
An asterisk refers us to Adventure Comics issue 69. Wesley continues,
"So I took him on as my ward and my partner."
And we see the Sandman in the purple and yellow suit, swinging along on a wire poon with Sandy the Golden Boy, young blonde teenager, in a blonde suit with red accessories, swinging along behind him. Obviously, since the Sandman has come back in JLA issue 46, he's been in the traditional gas mask and hat and suit outfit that he had in his initial stories. And as we all know, partway through his adventures in the Golden Age, he was rebooted as a more traditional spandex-clad superhero, yes, shall we say, and given the sidekick. And as we all know, Joe Simon and Jack Kirby did a lot of work on all that sort of stuff. Joe Simon and Jack Kirby have done some more Sandman work recently, which we've covered and we're going to keep covering because we've decided.
Yes.
Anyway, Wesley's narration in the flashback continues.
"The Sandman and Sandy, the Golden Boy. For years, it was a perfect team, but even the best can be improved upon. So I invented the silicoid gun."
And we see Sandman in his purple and yellow with Sandy working in a laboratory situation on this very sleek, modern, futuristic-looking sci-fi gun, with the Sandman saying,
"If this weapon works, it'll double our crime-fighting effectiveness."
To which Sandy says,
"It'll work, Sandman. Everything will be just swell. I know it will."
Sandman crosses to a retro-style computer bank behind him and says,
"Then cross your fingers, Sandy, while I throw the activator switch."
Wesley's narration continues at the top of page 5 as he reads,
"I threw the switch and the weapon hummed, a hum that quickly grew into a shrill, piercing whine. And before I could reverse the process, the world erupted into chaos around me."
There is a massive baroom explosion as the Sandman is sent flying into a wall. His narration for the next panel reads,
"And when the smoke of the explosion cleared..."
You see Sandy down on the ground. His costume has been torn in a few spots. He's obviously been caught in the explosion. He has a hand to his head. He looks in pain. Sandman leans towards him saying,
"Sandy, are you alright, kid?"
And his narration continues in the next panel.
"Painfully, I moved towards Sandy. And what happened next is a memory I'll take to the grave."
And what we see, Sandman beholds and exclaims,
"Sandy, he's changing! Becoming..."
And we see Sandy's body morphing into this enormous yellow stone giant with blazing red eyes, who exclaims,
"Fool, the one you call Sandy no longer exists. In his place I stand, I who will crush the earth beneath my feet, I who will make all men as I am, I who will..."
And the creature is reaching towards the Sandman, but then it tips forward in the next panel, and it continues.
My head's pounding. What's happening? What's... Ugh.
And with a massive thud sound effect, it crashes down on the ground. Poor Sandman is standing watching, saying,
some kind of side effect from the explosion and transformation. The strain is knocking Sandy out.
Wesley's narration continues.
I couldn't let Sandy roam free in that condition, so I imprisoned him in a gas-filled glass chamber that kept him in velvet, as comfortable as possible, and unconscious for all these many years. Until today.
And we see the giant stretched out in a massive bed. Where the heck he got it from, where he got the gas-filled glass chamber from, I've no idea. But we see poor Sandy lying unconscious as we reach the top of page 6, and Wesley's narration continues.
I couldn't face myself in the mirror after that. My reflection in that gold and purple costume was too harsh a reminder of what I had done. Finally, I tore the outfit to ribbons, dug this old double-breasted suit out of mothballs, and for better or worse, the original Sandman lived again.
We see him disposing of the, what many of us would call the Kirby Sandman costume. And take a drink, listeners, because a full moon looms in the background. Yay. As we see Wesley back in his, dare we say, traditional green suit, purple cape, brown fedora, and yellow and blue mask. We're back in the present day as he winds up his story, saying to the heroes,
and now, the thing I've dreaded most all these years has finally happened. Sandy has broken free of his velvet cage. And unless we recapture him quickly, any harm he causes will be my fault.
Ralph stretches into view, saying,
then what are you so worried about, Sandman? If all that has to be done is to track Sandy down, you have the greatest manhunters of two worlds to help you do it.
To which Superman says,
and we'd be proud to help, Sandman. Believe us.
And the Grainy Gladiator does believe them. Thus, moments later, three gaudily costumed search parties spread out across the dawn-lit face of York City in pursuit of a boy who might just be the greatest menace this world has ever known.
We see the superheroes have all split up into teams. Superman, Elongated Man, and Our Man rushing off to one side. Batman, Wonder Woman, and The Flash running towards us, and Green Lantern bearing the Sandman aloft as they fly off, all in the final panel of page 6. We arrive then at the top of page 7.
Let us turn our attention now to York City's sprawling Gladstone Park, where for two other young people, it is the dawn of a most special day.
Yes, it's very clear that a wedding is happening. We can see a table with a big cake on it. We can see the guests all met and arranged in the background in their fancy dresses and smart suits. There's a nice archway of flowers, would you say?
Yes.
Is that fair?
Yes. Yes, lovely. Hedged arch, yes.
I don't see any comic book themed covers highlighting and brightening everything up like I saw at someone else's wedding.
Yes, yes, yes.
It was fun. It was lovely.
I had an array of wedding-themed comic covers on my seating board for my wedding. 11 years ago now.
And it was a really nice image of Peter and Christine sort of operating a TARDIS console as well. Really cute. It was lovely. Anyway.
Thank you to Gavin Boyle for doing that for me. Cheers.
Finally giving him credit in public sometime. Anyway, back to the plot. There's an older, obviously the mother of the bride, slightly heavyset woman, curly red hair, wearing a pink fitted suit. Her daughter's dark hair, very slim-hipped, a fancy veil, little crown of flowers. And we also see her intended, a thin-looking boy with dark hair, looks very, very nervous. But the girl's mother is saying,
Giselle, darling, I know what's-his-name is a nice boy, but couldn't you marry instead a doctor?
Giselle says,
Mother, please don't start in again now.
But then what's-his-name arrives in the next panel saying,
Giselle, darling, I think everybody's ready to begin.
Giselle sings,
coming, Patrick, my love.
And her mother says,
Giselle, today will be the happiest day of your life.
And she thinks,
from here on in, it's straight downhill.
That's depressing, isn't it? A slow dissolve capture for panel 3 reads,
and moments after,
we see the grey-haired minister with his back to us, Bible in front of him. Patrick looks a bit sad, a bit nervous. Giselle looks steely-eyed, there's no other word for it. We can see her mum crying in the background. She's overwhelmed with emotion of it all. The minister is saying, and if there be any who should show just cause why these two should not be wed, let him speak now, or forever hold his, but he's interrupted by a...
Rah!
And then in the next panel, with an even louder...
Rah!
The hideous form of the stone statue version of Sandy, with his red eyes blaring, appears over the hedges and trees, looking down at the wedding party. Giselle screams,
Hey! A monster! monster! A monster!
Her mother cries,
I knew it! I knew we should have rented City Hall!
Patrick, who's now losing all hope, yells,
Help! Somebody help!
And then thankfully, in the next panel, the Man of Steel arrives, saying,
Hold on, son. Help is on the way.
Patrick looks round and recognizes two of the heroes and he says,
Superman! Our man! And...
And the stretchable sleuth says,
Try elongated man, buddy!
In the first panel of page 8 with another,
Rawr!
Sandy gestures with his right hand and a burst of pink energy comes from his hand and strikes the ground. Elongated man says,
Not much of a conversationalist, are you, kid?
Superman says,
Strange. It's where Sandman described the transformed Sandy as being able to talk.
This prompts our man to say,
Which is something I suggest you stop doing, unless you want to stop breathing too.
And the next panel, God, this is crazy. Superman very helpfully tells us,
Oh, great Scott. That ray, the creature fired, transforming the ground beneath us into gigantic stone hands.
And that's what we see. This is proper Doctor Who horror stuff. Giant stone hands emerging from the ground, one grabbing Superman, one grabbing Elongated Man, and one grabbing Our Man, who says,
We're trapped! But we're not going to stay that way. Good thing I took a Miraculo pill when we spotted Sandy. I'll be superpowered for the next hour.
And with that, Our Man punches his way to freedom. Superman also manages to punch his way out of the hand that was holding him, and Ralph manages to stretch out of the one that was holding him, saying,
So what are we waiting for?
Valiantly, the three bold champions hurl themselves at their grotesque adversary.
Yeah, we see the three lads rushing towards Sandy, and Superman says,
Remember, men, try not to hurt the kid.
Only to discover, to their chagrin...
With a walk, Sandy punches Superman, sending him flying, and he grabs Our Man by the wrist, swings him round, striking Elongated Man with a thud as Our Man says,
Hurt him? What about, oof, us?
Listeners, I'll urge you to pay close attention to the socials this week with the final panel of page 8 in mind, because a recolorized version of it was used for the Spanish reprint of this story, and you'll see that on the socials in a couple of days. We arrive at the top of page 9.
And while our harried heroes struggle to regain their senses...
Yes, we see Giselle and Patrick standing watching, and Giselle says,
Pat, please do something to help them!
Me? Darling, you've got to be kidding.
Patrick, I'm warning you. If you don't do something, I will!
Bellowing in seeming triumph, the creature that was once Sandy Hawkins prepares to dash the invulnerable body of Superman down upon those of his companions.
Rex and Ralph on the ground, Sandy roaring with soups in his hand, raising up...
Rawr!
When, suddenly, he is interrupted by a...
Splat!
Yes, he's struck by almost a custard pie in the right eye, which makes him drop Superman.
Other less dynamic heroes enter into the fray.
Yes, we see Giselle and Patrick and the rest of the wedding guests who are grabbing, obviously, some of the puddings or pieces of cake, whatever, that are on plates and hurling them at Sandy. Giselle says,
Spoil my wedding, will you, you awful thing? Oh, Pat, I'm so proud of you.
And her new husband says,
Compliment me later. For now, just keep throwing.
Final panel, the heroes have woken up a little bit. Superman says,
What in the name of Krypton is going on here?
I'm not sure. But I think we've just been rescued by the Keystone Cops.
Can you imagine? This prompts Our Man to say,
And from the way Sandy is rushing at those folks, I'd say it's a favor we better return, and fast.
Yes, we see Sandy looming towards the wedding guests, and the caption of the first panel of page 10 reads,
And fast is exactly the word for it.
Yep, Superman has flown up and down, struck Sandy from behind, Rex has grabbed Sandy by the right arm, Ralph has looped himself around his left arm, and they're pulling him down to the ground. Our Man says,
Got him! In the proverbial nick, as they say.
This prompts Ralph to say,
Getting him is one thing, but I think our problem is going to be holding him.
Sandy roars in panel 2.
Rawr!
Ralph is completely wrapped around him at this point. It doesn't look safe, but he says,
Doesn't sound like Sandy is too happy about this.
Superman, struggling to keep a hold of Sandy's leg, says,
I'm not interested in amusing him, EM. Just restraining him long enough for the others to get there.
But that may be even more difficult than it seems, for suddenly...
Our Man helpfully points out...
Suffering second hands!
Has he ever said that before?
Sandy is turning into sand?
And sure enough, the giant stone figure seems to be dissolving. Elongated Man says...
He's sifting through my fingers! I can't hold him!
Sandy departs with a final...
Rawr!
Panel 4, the heroes are standing, basically looking at nothing. Superman says...
He's gone.
Our Man says,
We'll never find him again in a place like this.
And after a thorough search has proven our man right.
See Patrick and Giselle and Giselle's mother and the other guests do their round. Superman saying,
"Forgive us, ladies and gentlemen, for intruding upon your ceremony this way. We'll leave you to your wedding now, and thanks for the helping hand."
To which Giselle's mum says,
"You shouldn't mention it. For you, Mr. Superman, anytime."
As the heroes depart in the final panel of page 10, Giselle's mum, whose hair has gone white from the trauma of this wedding, is saying,
"Listen, Giselle, you sure you couldn't marry a nice boy like that Superman instead of what's his name?"
"Mother, I happen to love... what's his name?"
Tiny caption tells her we're continuing the third page following. Past advertisement for Big Jim's Kung Fu and Sport Action Sweepstakes.
Yay.
Listeners, did you take part? Write in and let us know. Pete will tell you how to at the end of the episode. And we arrive at top of page 11, where a caption reads,
"While you turned the pages, we've turned our attention to a sandlot baseball field midway across York City, where..."
Yeah, we see some teenagers playing baseball. There's a red-haired kid in the foreground with a bat. One of his friends behind him shouts,
"Come on, Howie, hit it this time."
Another boy yells,
"Ha! Easy out! Easy out!"
And one kid standing at the back of the whole thing says, "Ah, Howie couldn't hit the side of a barn." In panel two, we see Howie thinking, "Easy out, huh? Boy, I'll show him. This time I will get a hit. Oh my gosh!" A massive shadow has fallen over him. And in panel three, the shadow is revealed to be caused by Sandy, who roars.
"Roar!"
The kids run for it. The boy who'd been standing at the back says, "What is that?" One of the others says,
"Who knows? Anything it wants to be."
And Howie yells, "Run! There's nothing to stop that thing from getting us."
"Nothing, young man. What about this?"
And Sandy roars in surprise.
"Roar!"
As he's suddenly lassoed by Wonder Woman, who says,
"That will be just about far enough, my friend."
But as the Amazon princess tightens her hold on the boy turned behemoth.
Yeah, Batman and Flash are arriving in the scene as well as Wonder Woman observes,
"Suffering Sappho! My magic lasso pulls through his body as if it were made of sand."
And indeed, Sandy roars as he basically phases himself out of the lasso. He stands facing the heroes in the final panel of page 11, the Flash running up towards him saying,
"Hang on, gang, I'll hit him so fast he won't know what hit him."
But Batman calls,
"Flash, no, hold on a minute. Maybe the proper judo hold can subdue him without unnecessary violence."
Batman leaps towards him and the Flash pulls himself up saying,
"Well, if anyone can handle a job like that, it's the Batman."
But then the caption for panel two reads,
"Apparently it can't be done, for suddenly..."
Yes, with a swok. Sandy roars and sends Batman flying. This prompts J Flash to say,
"Well, so much for that idea.
What do we do now, Flash? Somehow we must capture that creature without doing it permanent harm."
And as Batman rubs his head to recover in panel three, J Flash runs towards Sandy saying,
"I know our restrictions, Wonder Woman, but I'll see what I can do."
And then he thinks,
"Without getting myself flattened in the bargain."
With speed almost too blinding to believe, the fastest man on Earth 2 whirls about the raging monstrosity.
Brilliant panel of J-Flash rushing towards Sandy and starting to circle him as he thinks,
"He hasn't moved from this spot since we found him. He's just standing there roaring as if, no, it couldn't be possible, could it? Regardless, that's something I can worry about after I bring the transformed Sandy under control. And that shouldn't be long, thanks to this vacuum vortex I'm whipping up. Even a monster such as this must need air to remain conscious."
And we see the Flash, whose shirt has turned yellow from the exertion, running round in circles around Sandy, who still looks very annoyed and angry, throwing up clouds of dust and obviously draining the air away from him. And the caption for the first panel on page 13 reads,
"But at that instant, to the Scarlet Speedster's amazement..."
Yes, Jay looks up and thinks,
"What the? A hail of sand shifting out of the vortex at incredible speed. Sandy is using my whirlwind himself to create a sandstorm."
And we see that once again, the stone figure has dissolved into sand, the caption for panel two.
"And caught in the unnatural phenomenon's path..."
Yep, we see a few kids trying to hide in the shelter of a tree, not really working too well. Wonder Woman observes,
"Batman, look! By that tree, children! With no possible hope of shelter!"
"Then we had best become the shelter, Wonder Woman, and quickly."
Like unyielding walls against the storm, the Caped Crusader and Amazing Amazon come between the whistling, stinging sands and the helpless, panic-stricken children.
Yes, Batman raises his cape, protecting them all from the worst of it, and he says,
"The wind's incredibly strong, almost bowling me over."
And then he cries,
"Stop, Flash, stop! You're causing more trouble than results."
And we see that Jay is still running in a circular motion and creating the whirlwind that Sandy is now using to scatter himself far and wide.
And when the fastest man alive skids to a halt,
That's better. Cutting my speed cut the power behind the sandstorm. So the... Huh?
Sandy is... gone.
Somehow he used that storm of his to blow himself away. For someone who's been in cold storage for so many years, he's a shrewd little devil.
He's more than that, Flash. I have the feeling there's a lot more to this puzzle than meets the bat-cowled eye.
Fantastic. We arrive at the top of page 14.
Okay, let's jump again. This time a half hour forward in time and halfway across town. To York City's famed Machismo Beach, where virile young athletes flaunt their accomplishments to the delighted squeals of their lovely companions.
This is so 70s, it's unbelievable. It's like the man that made a thingy out of Mac advert come to life, almost, or preempting the King of the Beach episode of The Incredible Hulk. We see some tanned, muscly, buff guys pulling shapes and flexing their biceps, and a gaggle of bikini-clad lovelies making love heart and doe eyes and observing and delighting in what they're seeing.
And where a certain boy-turned-monster is most obviously out of place.
Yes, once again with a...
roar!
Sandy takes form, almost like he's just appearing out of the beach. One of the muscle-bound lads cries...
Warren, what the heck is that?
And one of the girls cries...
Oh, Ernie, it's a monster.
Don't worry, honey. Me and the guys won't let that ugly awful touch a hair on your pretty head.
And with that, Ernie and two of his mates lunge forward to try and tackle Sandy, who roars once again.
But such a confident blast seems a trifle premature, as...
Basically, as one of Ernie's mates collides face first with the beach, he says, what? It shrugged us off like we were just dandruff or something. What do we do now? And indeed, poor Ernie seems to be... good, he could have broken his neck the way he's landing there. What do you do now? Well, very helpfully, Green Lantern tells us as he arrives,
you do nothing, friend, except get out of harm's way.
And leave poor Sandy to us,
concludes the Sandman. Once again, Sandy roars at the sight of the two heroes. And at the top of page 15, Green Lantern hops into the air just above Sandy, creating a massive green hand with his ring and thinking,
have to remember, Sandy is probably not responsible for his actions. I'll ring myself up a giant hand and grab him as gently as I can. Huh? The hand's going right through. Of course. I should have realized. The silicone structure of Sandy is primarily yellow in color.
And we got another little star that takes us to another little caption box that reminds us.
And Green Lantern's power ring will not work upon the color yellow. And it should say due to unnecessary impurity within the battery.
Yes, because we all know how that ends up, don't we? Blackest Night, etc., Sinestro Corps, etc., yada, yada, yada. Green Lantern's not down. Hal tries again. He fires another beam of energy towards Sandy, thinking,
well, maybe a concentrated burst of energy can pass through the silicone molecules and... great guardians! The silicone crystals are acting as a prism, breaking my green beam into all the colours of the rainbow.
Now, if that's not foreshadowing developments in the early 2000s, I don't know what does. Yes, sure enough, a prism is bursting out the back of Sandy. Sandy is multitasking like nothing else. The caption for panel 4.
And that's not all, apparently, for suddenly...
yep, Sandy roars and gestures towards Hal. A little spark of green energy comes out of his finger and strikes Green Lantern, who falls backwards, thinking,
huh? He's absorbed some of the energy as well, firing it back at...
Dazed, the Emerald Gladiator sprawls in the sand, as one who has taken this very substance as his namesake surveys the scene and ponders.
Yes, the Sandman is on the scene and he's thinking,
Green Lantern, hurt, defeated, yet Sandy is the cause of it. That boy was like a son to me and now... no, must stop thinking like that. My fault or otherwise, Sandy is a menace now. And it's up to me to stop him.
And with that, the Sandman rushes forward. In the first panel of page 16, his inner monologue continues.
I've filled my gas gun with the same vapors that held Sandy in check these many years. So one good whiff of it is all it should take to put him into suspended animation.
And with that, Sandman fires his gun at Sandy, creating a cloud of pink smoke. Sandy roars.
But to the Sleep Master's chagrin.
No good. We're in too open an area. The breeze is drifting in on the tide or dissipating my gas before Sandy can be affected by it.
The noxious fumes vanquished, the creature that was once Sandy Hawkins turns furiously on the gas-masked gladiator who was once his friend and mentor.
And as Sandy rears up, Sandman thinks,
He's going to attack me? No, I can't believe that. Sandy couldn't hurt me.
For an instant, huge misshapen hands seem to reach for the Sandman's throat. Then, those massive arms tremble. Clench, and at last relax, the fury in them drained.
The sandy creature seems to have calmed down. Sandman stands in front of him, saying,
Sandy, I knew you could never harm me. In fact, I bet my life on it.
But unfortunately, those sentiments do not hold true for everyone.
There is a sudden manic burst of red energy and a thwam sound effect. Sandy recoils and Wesley cries,
Sandy!
And Superman flies in at this point, saying,
Good shot, Our Man.
You see, the other heroes have arrived. Green Lantern is recovering. Our Man says,
Looks like we got here in the nick of time. One second more and that monster might have killed you.
You see that Sandy is now stretched out, seemingly unconscious on the ground. And Sandman thoughtfully says,
Yeah, sure.
And as we arrive at the top of page 17, Wonder Woman says,
Well, our problem at the moment is deciding exactly what to do with Sandy.
To which Elongated Man says,
We can return him to his cell. And with the rest of us to help you, finding a cure for him shouldn't be too...
But then he's interrupted by the caption for panel 2.
Then it happens. The ground beneath the assembled heroes trembles and shakes, as if at last releasing a long-repressed shudder.
Yes, we see the heroes dancing around almost in the Lost in Space style. Something's happening. Superman says,
Great Scott! Ground tremors!
Ground tremors, my elongated eye! This is a full-fledged earthquake!
Yes, and horrifically in panel 3, page 17, the ground splits open and Our Man, Batman and Sandman tip into the chasm. Our Man cries,
A fissure opening beneath us!
Sandman says,
Nothing to grab hold of!
And Batman points out that they are...
Falling!
But not very far if I have anything to say about it.
And with Superman the Flash standing idly by, it's the Elongated Man who speeds into action, stretching both of his upper limbs down into the hole, saying,
Grab hold of my arms, guys, and hang on!
Yep, he loops around Batman, and Our Man and Sandman grab a hold too.
Almost instantly, the Elongated Man pulls his companions to safety. Then...
Yep, Green Lantern conjures once again with his power ring, saying,
Got to stop the fissure before it spreads any further. And a power-reined clamp should be just what the doctor ordered.
Yes, we see a massive green vise has suddenly appeared and is being used to close up the gap in the ground. Thank goodness for that, and thank goodness for the caption in the first panel of page 18.
The immediate danger over, Green Lantern turns from the fissure, gestures urgently to two of his teammates, then...
Remember, they're at the beach at this point, and Green Lantern starts walking into the water, saying...
That tremor originated at sea. We'd better locate the source before it can create any new problems.
Yes, and the heroes he gestured to are Wonder Woman and Superman who follow him, Superman saying,
Meanwhile, the rest of you had better get those swimmers out of here.
And brief moments later...
Yes, we can see the fault spreading across the surface of the ocean floor. The heroes descending towards it, and for the next couple of panels, Green Lantern, Wonder Woman and Superman have got little jagged effects on their speech bubbles because they're obviously communicating using some kind of underwater radio. Green Lantern in a power bubble says,
That's the fault line, all right. Runs as far as the eye can see.
And if we don't do something to correct that fault, it could destroy York City the next time it slips.
That shouldn't be too difficult. Wonder Woman, may I borrow your magic lasso?
Certainly, but why?
Hang in there a second, and you'll see.
Says the Man of Steel, and the next panel's glorious. The caption reads,
Then, almost faster than the eye can follow, the remarkable Man of Steel goes to work with a makeshift needle and thread. Stitching the ground fault together with the indestructible magic lasso. Then, fusing it shut with a sudden burst of super pressure.
Yes, I'm guessing that Hal created a big needle for him using his power ring, even though the magic lasso is sort of yellow in colour.
Maybe Superman crafted it out of something.
Maybe he crafted it out of thin air, like...
Some makeshift coral.
Like the Martian Manhunter did with that tape recorder that one time that yes. I was talking about. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Supes has done it. With a thwump, he finishes tying up the fault, thinking...
There, that should do it. Not a chance of the fissure ever slipping again.
And when Superman has retrieved the golden lasso...
Yep, he hands it back to Wonder Woman, saying...
Thanks for the loan of the lariat, Princess. Could never have pulled that stunt off without it.
In the foreground, a thoughtful Green Lantern says,
But our job's not done yet. I'll head back along the Fisher's Path and check for damage.
Very conscientious of you, Hal. Good job.
Shortly, back on shore.
Yes, we're at the top of page 19 now. The heroes are all standing on the beach as Green Lantern alights. Our Man says,
Well, Lantern, how did it go? How much cleaning up have we got ahead of us?
Believe it or not, Our Man, absolutely none.
He lands and says,
What's more... The fault line passes directly under the sites where we all confronted Sandy.
And this prompts Elongated Man to scratch his head and say,
If there's a connection there, I'm not sure I follow it, Green.
But he's interrupted by a voice saying,
Please, help me.
Sandman whirls and says,
Who? Sandy, you can speak again, but how? Why? Just minutes ago, you were a rampaging monster.
And we see that the sand creature is starting to get to its feet. It looks a lot more calm, and it replies,
A monster, yes, I was. But I had no other choice. When the first tremor shattered, my glass cell reviving me, my mutated body instantly sensed the fault line running beneath York City. To prevent a citywide disaster, I had to track those tremors to their source, using my body to absorb the ground vibrations as I went.
The Flash says,
Then my hunter's right. You weren't roaring in anger, but in pain. Stilling those tremors must have been agony.
Batman says,
Granted, Flash, but that still doesn't explain why Sandy attacked us.
I'm sorry about that, but I couldn't let you stop me, or the vibrations would have torn the city apart.
Superman says,
But why didn't you just explain the situation to us? We would have certainly understood.
I tried to tell you at first, but my vocal cords wouldn't respond.
Which Sandman says,
All those years of disuse must have temporarily paralyzed them. Sandy, what did I do to you?
In the first panel of page 20, the Sandman, looking distraught, approaches his friend, saying,
I had to do what I did, Sandy. You understand that, don't you? You become a menace, a raving lunatic.
But that was only a temporary effect of the explosion, Wes. I regained my senses within hours. But that gas was so physically disabling, there was never any way for me to tell you.
Sandman turns away, his head in his hands, as he says,
God, oh God, what have I done? All these years, so many years of Sandy's life, wasted! Because I jumped to conclusions. Because I was too proud, too ashamed to admit what I had caused.
Sandman looks utterly dejected in panel 3, saying,
Sandy, please, I beg of you, forgive me.
He starts to walk away from the other heroes in panel 4 as Wonder Woman says,
Poor Sandman. I can't stand to see him torture himself so, when there may be no reason to. New breakthroughs in Amazon science may be able to restore Sandy to his normal self. I must tell Sandman before...
But Batman puts a hand on her shoulder, saying,
No, Wonder Woman. Restoring Sandy will be the simplest part of all this. But how do you restore a man's pride? His confidence? How do you restore a man's soul?
And Batman and Wonder Woman look as Sandman stands separate from the others, seagulls arching in the evening sky. And a small caption reads,
The end.
Next, join the world's greatest heroes, and then some, on a terror-laden trip down memory lane to confront a villain as old as tomorrow's headline, and as new as the dawn of time. Make it a point to be here, friend, for the return of Arachronis.
Yes, but you can find that on another podcast. There we have it then, the 1974 JLA-JSA team-up, the third consecutive one to feature the return of a Golden Age hero who hadn't been seen for a very long time.
Yes, very true.
Listeners, you don't need us to remind you that the last couple of years had featured the Freedom Fighters and the Seven Soldiers.
Yes.
And now it's the return of...
Sandy the Golden Boy.
Last seen in the pages of Adventure Comics issue 102, published in December 1945.
Wow.
So we've been gone for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting one. I'm sure it was probably a question that fans probably raised at the time, you know.
Yeah.
Why is the Sandman back in his suit and what happened to Sandy?
Yes, very much so. I find it absolutely fascinating that none of the other JSAers ever brought up the topic of Sandy with Sandman.
That's a good point,
actually.
In all
this time.
Well, there is that point at the top of page 4 when Jay says, Wes, what are you talking about? Sandy Hawkins left York City years ago.
Yeah, but given how many scientists and magicians are in the JSA, they might have been able to help him transform him back. Is this his fatal flaw? Is this the Shakespearean fatal flaw of Wes Dodds?
He maybe felt too guilty or too scared to let everyone know. I mean, I think you make an excellent point. Dr. Fate probably could have sorted something out. Ted Knight, sure as heck, probably could have helped him reverse engineer a cure, maybe. Mm-hmm. Dr. Midnight could have stood around sagely rubbing his chin. It's, you know, you're right. It's obviously the case that whenever any of them asked, Wesley lied about it, probably because, you know, as you say, he was maybe too proud. I don't know.
It is a tragedy, though, that
Sandy was
conscious all that time but couldn't do anything about it.
It really is.
Also, his recovery, his vocal cords had frozen and he couldn't communicate properly. I'm very familiar with that from recent months.
Recent months. Yes, Sandy actually had to get Logan and Steve to communicate for him. Obviously, it's very, very clever, obviously, to get Logan to voice Sandy this time. It is a tragedy because Sandy, obviously, you know, This isn't the end of his story. There's a sequence of stories over DC Comics Presents in the early 80s called Whatever Happened To, which will return to this. So it's not just as simple as what Wonder Woman suggests. And of course, Sandy would go on to be a member of the Justice Society of America and the team that was formed in 1999. I mean, it's interesting because for a long time, there was some doubt as to whether or not Sandy still existed in post-crisis continuity. We'll probably have this conversation again when we do that DCP story, but I think it's worth talking about now because when I first got this issue of JLA, summer of 1993, which was just a few months after Sandman Mystery Theater had just started.
Okay.
So I was getting used to the Guy Davis, Wesley Dodds, this, you know, the slightly retound, bespectacled figure who looks nothing like this ridiculously handsome man who's on, you know, the early pages of this issue of JLA that we've just covered. I remember actually, I don't know if it was this story or one of the early adventure comics, saying to my wee sister, like, look at Wesley and Diane compared to what they're like, to what we're used to from the more realistic versions of Sandman Mystery Theatre. And again, we will probably touch on this stuff again in a future episode, but there was a story arc that developed in Sandman Mystery Theatre when Diane put on a disguise and was identified as Sandy. And I remember a letter in the letters column of SMT sort of saying, what, Diane Sandy? And of course, there was that period in the 90s when the sort of Vertigo version of Wesley was kind of folded into the main continuity. Ross has very recently on Opal City Confidential has done the team up between Wesley and Jack Knight, run about issue 22, 23 of the James Robinson Starman, has a flashback to the 40s and the Golden Age Starman is very much rendered in the Vertigo style rather than you know, the style he would have been rendered in the 40s. And there was no mention ever made of Sandy, the proper Sandy in SMT. And for a long time, before he turned up in the 1999 JSA series, a lot of folk thought he'd just been retconned as not existing at all.
Yeah.
When they did the Justice Society Returns storyline, which obviously was bookended by two issues of All-Star Comics at the beginning of 1999, one issue foregrounded and featured Sandy and Stripesy together.
Yes.
And there's a moment in that when Sandy sort of talks about how Stalker's disciple has been turned into a raging monster and he sort of thinks, oh, that's terrible, I can't imagine that happening. I remember at the time thinking, yes, that's a very clumsy bit of
foreshadowing,
yes. So, but it was good, it was nice, it kind of brought Sandy back into visibility and a lot of us were kind of like, oh, right, he does exist then. And of course then when the series sort of started properly, the JSA series started properly a couple of months later, Sandy was a full-fledged member of it. We won't say too much more about that because we'll talk about it further when we do his DC Comics Presents storyline in about 3 years.
Probably. We're going to be doing an awful lot of those, whatever happened to us, because they are great. Yeah.
We're going to pack them in. I'm thinking at least four an episode.
Gasp!
Yeah, at least. We won't do every single one of them, but we'll do the ones that obviously are relevant to the Golden Age heroes.
We'll be doing Rex the Wonder Dog. Yes.
Yeah, I want to do the Western Johnny Thunder one as well.
Yes.
Anyway. It's going to be great. That's all in the future. And don't anyone else go stealing our thunder and doing a devoted podcast series to that before we get there. It's an interesting mix of heroes. I mean, this is the third one in a row that Sandman appears in. And after this, the Wesley Dodds Sandman is not seen very much at all.
No.
Before the crisis at all. He pops up in a couple of issues of All-Star Comics.
Yeah.
Pops up in a couple of issues of Infinity Inc. But that's basically it. And I was sort of wondering the question I put to you, Peter Watson.
Indeed.
Do you think Sandman was taken off the table at this point because of the Jack Kirby, Joe Simon series?
I think that's a possibility. Because obviously the Simon Kirby one, obviously we've just had the special. That's all we've had so far. And obviously they've had some reaction to it at this point. But it's been too soon, really, to have any kind of knock-on effect to have this story written and drawn and planned.
Yeah, it's coincidental, isn't it?
It is, but it's also one of these nice coincidences that seems to have a logical progression to it.
It works very well from the fact that, you know, obviously there's going to be another five issues of that Sandman and then he's going to turn up elsewhere. But it's
different editors in the titles as well, so obviously there's no collusion there.
Yeah, I wonder if maybe I think it's a happy accident, isn't it? Synchronicity is probably the best way of putting it. It's very timely of it all happening. And it just lets us talk a bit more about Sandman. I mean, this is a really, really interesting story to read when you're such, like me, I'm a massive fan of the Vertigo series.
Yeah.
In some ways, I actually even rate it above Starman.
Ooh, interesting.
They're both very similar in that they're very consistent, but I think Starman is probably better overall. I think Sandman Mystery Theater, once Matt Wagner left, and with no disrespect to Steven Seagal or Siegel, it kind of tips off a little bit, and it was cancelled, obviously, mid-storyline, practically.
Right.
It's unresolved, whereas Starman is a bit more complete. And obviously there has just recently been the very good, the excellent, in fact, Wesley Dodds Golden Age Starman miniseries, which I'll probably put some covers up this week on the social thing. I've got quite a lot of the variants, so I'll probably pick a few covers. Thanks to Peter and Clive at Forbidden Planet at Glasgow.
You're welcome, sir.
Sort me out with all those, God bless you. I'll stick some of them up in the socials this week to kind of dazzle and delight you. It's been a good period to be a Sandman fan this last couple of weeks. This series coming out as we've been doing all this. It's just fascinating just to as I keep saying, so used to the Vertigo version.
Uh-huh.
And obviously, you know, we've been rereading the Jack Kirby stuff, and I've got a lot more to say about the 70s Sandman, obviously, when we cover some of the other issues of that, because there's a whole bunch of stuff I'd forgotten about that he was involved in that I'm going to mention. It's fascinating just seeing Sandy being referenced, because that whole second half of the Golden Age Sandman's adventures is so, especially when Kirby got involved, is so completely different from the atmospheric, moody stuff of the early stories, which, you know, a couple of which we've done.
It certainly is, and they also give him the most generic costume, the yellow outfit with the purple hoods and, you know, the purple accessories, because we know obviously the Tarantula had pretty much an identical costume. And also the Black Hood, the Archie character, he is pretty much exactly the same costume.
Yeah, I mean, put the three of them in a line, it would take you a second to work out who was who.
Yep.
No, you're right. I mean, and obviously that aspect is something else that is going to be touched on in All-Star Squadron.
Yes.
Eventually, when we get there. Mm-hmm. I've got a lot to say about what Roy Thomas did.
Yes.
Reconciling all of this.
We both have. I think I read somewhere that Roy was quite disappointed it wasn't the business suit version. But obviously, from his strict continuity, he was taking it from Pearl Harbor, pretty much, and that's that point, what costume he was in then.
Wesley was in the purple and yellow, absolutely. So, I mean, there's not going to be too much more Wesley Dodds Sandman chat for the rest of the duration of the podcast, unfortunately. So this week will probably be the week that I post the book that Kelly sent me a few years ago, the hardcover French black and white reprints of the Kirby and Sandman.
Yeah.
Post some samples from that on the socials this week as well, listeners, as it's Sandman Week of the Earth 2 podcast. So, yeah, it's an interesting story. I think I enjoyed that Ralph got to use his powers that...
Yes, Ralph to the rescue, indeed.
Yeah, Hal got to do some stuff, that Superman got to do some very Silver Age-y Superman stuff, in as much as he's sewing up a fault line. I can't imagine him doing that in pages of Superman, really.
No, not with Wonder Woman's lasso, anyway. No,
at this point. It's interesting that because it's not too long that after Ralph joined the Justice League, and it's nice that he's been foregrounded as much as he has. And,
oh, yeah, definitely. And he's an integral part now. Integral part. I love how the story kicks off, and we're just right in the middle of the action. No explanation of why they're on Earth 2. Why have the heroes travelled over? Is it just the annual team-up, just going over to visit their pals? This Horned Owl gang, have they transported over from Earth 1, perhaps? Also, the Horned Owl gang, I love how their costumes are very reminiscent of the New Mutants.
Yes, I mean, or the original X-Men.
Yes,
Yeah, that whole yellow and black. And they reminded me of, actually, it's a good point, they reminded me of the sort of Annie-Men type guys that pop in Marvel Comics.
Yes,
X-Men 94, 95. And I think in the Avengers as well. There's a later issue of the Avengers.
Yep.
Obviously, listeners, we'll dig out our copies of X-Men 94 and 95 and maybe photograph some pals. Probably not. There might not be room in the socials this week, but I might get a tweet out of it at least. Yeah, they're very interesting. I mean, you know, as we sort of said, it's just a one-issue story this week, so maybe that's one of the areas they might have expanded upon.
Mm-hmm.
There might have been a sort of preamble at the start with them, a couple of pages of them jumping over. Maybe some other heroes have gone to Earth 1, and there's a whole adventure happening there. I'm imagining it right now.
Good.
Maybe the Atom and Dr. Fate and Dr. Midnight and Starman are all having a kick about with Green Arrow, Hawkman, Black Canary, and Red Tornado while we're talking.
You may well be.
When you and I write our DC comic.
We'll be doing that.
Yeah, we'll be talking
Meanwhile on Earth 1, we'll call it. Yeah,
meanwhile on Earth 1.
I love that Wesley's secret hideout is under a giant hourglass. It's a bit of a giveaway for the secret ID, though, isn't it?
Sands of Time.
Yes, you might think it's either he could secretly be Sandman or he could secretly be Our Man. It could be either.
it's fascinating that Rex knows where all that is. And Rex doesn't even seem annoyed that Sandman's appropriated his symbolism.
Well, it's sand inside the hourglass.
Yeah, that's true.
I wonder what book he's actually pulling to activate the secret lever.
I bet he's pulling out a copy of Altered Egos by, or whatever it's called, by Jonathan Law. Is that what his book was called?
Yeah, so.
I bet that's what Altered it is. Ego,
yeah,
can you imagine?
Yeah. I'm imagining it right now.
Or maybe it's his copy of the complete Joe Simon and Jack Kirby, or maybe it's his copy of the Commandy Archives Volume 1. Listeners, honestly, see off the back of doing issue 1 of the Kirby Sandman the other week, like I've read OMAC in its entirety for the 70s OMAC in its entirety for the first time, and I've been reading I think I've finally tuned into 70s Kirby in a way that I never have before, and I've also, you wouldn't be surprised to learn, collected nearly a full run of OMAC despite having the hardback collection, and I'm starting to grab as many cheap commandies as possible.
Good.
I was saying this to Ross the other night on the socials, I reckon I'll have a full set of commandy by the end of the year.
Wow. Okay.
Target. Self-challenge extended.
Send me what numbers you need.
I shall. Yeah, actually, some of that's going to be quite relevant to another episode that's coming up in a couple of weeks. Listeners, that might surprise you. So I'm not going to say any more at this time.
Yes.
Because I want to surprise Peter also. Anything else to add, Peter? I'm aware that I've had quite a lot to say about this story.
You're very enthused about it, yeah. Well,
Wesley's one of my main men. He's one of my main guys.
True, true. I did love the hilarious wedding scene.
Yes.
It was great. I wonder where the father of the bride is.
Maybe he's dead.
Maybe he's dead.
Maybe he was killed by one of the villains that the Sandman fought in the Golden Age.
By the Nightshades,
yes. Yeah, something like that. Or maybe the original Tarantula. Or maybe the Phantom of the Fair. No, that was a very amusing insert. Breaks things up nicely. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed the custard pie fight. And just as that bit where Ralph says, I think we've been rescued by the Keystone Cops, is amazing.
Do the kids these days even know who the Keystone Cops are?
Listeners, do you know who the Keystone Cops are? Write and let us know.
They're the police force in Keystone City, of course.
Of course. And which brings us to York City.
Yeah.
I don't remember any mention of that elsewhere ever.
No,
we're
no.
going to have to go through our complete collections of adventure comics in the 40s and see if there's any mention of York City. But of course, like, there is some continuity. There's a beach, they're down by the water. We did do that story where the Sandman was cutting about the docks and fighting Wing a few months ago.
Do you find the ending of this a bit dissatisfying in that Sandman saying, Sandy, please, I beg of you, forgive me? And we don't actually see Sandy after that. We don't know what Sandy's reaction is to that.
Yeah. It's very effective, it's very emotive, you know, as the sun is setting and the colouring is beautiful throughout this issue. You know, we can see the kind of purple skies creeping in. Mm-hmm. I didn't like the fact the last word was left to Batman.
Yeah.
I felt like it should have been Our Man of the Flash, one of his Justice Society colleagues, to be honest.
Yeah, or indeed Sandy, you know. Yeah. It'd be good if Sandy had just, like, taken him in his arms and just held him and maybe even ended in that.
Yeah, no, I agree strongly. It's interesting that he's left and sort of that Wonder Woman and her pals will just fix it, the Amazons will cure him and stuff. But,
yeah.
You know, I suppose in one reality that may well happen, but it's not until issue 47 of DC Comics Presents. You know, it's a long time. I mean, that comic is published in April 1982, so it's what?
8 years later.
Roughly 8 years later, yeah. Which in the scheme of things, from our perspective, doesn't seem that long because it's that's about as long as where we are now is from when DC Rebirth happened, practically.
Oh, okay, yeah.
When you think about it. But it's still longer than the Confederacy. Yeah, I mean, that's one good thing about those little DC Comics Presents backups is that they do tie up so many little dangling threads. Like the Western Johnny Thunder one is amazing. It literally picks up.
And the Crimson Avenger one is just glorious. It's one of the best stories ever.
That one will get an episode on its own.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
There's so much we'll say about that one. There's so much that's been done even with that story recently.
Yeah, true.
With the Stargirl, recent Stargirl series. But no, I agree with you, to be honest. I think it's a little unsatisfying. It's only a 20-page story this month. A couple of pages shorter than some of the other ones that we've done around this time.
So much packed into it.
There was room, I think, maybe for another couple of pages for to show that reconciliation.
If this had been a two-parter, what do you think would have been in it that isn't in it currently?
Well, like I said earlier, I think we'd have got some of the preamble about them moving over and maybe Sandy attacking either the wedding or something would have been a cliffhanger, I think.
Yeah.
It might have spread some of that out, I think. Maybe there's... So, I mean, I think it was very well paced.
Yeah.
It never felt like it was flagging. Nothing felt crammed in. It didn't feel like... The last page, even though we were maybe a little dissatisfied with it, it didn't feel like, say, for example, the last page of issue one of The Sandman, where Jack's panels were getting smaller and smaller to fit everything in. I think Len did a brilliant job on it. This is probably the good point to see what Len says about it in the introduction to Crisis and Multiple Lotta Volume 3. When the time came around again for the annual JLA-JSA team-up, Julie and I found we had a new problem. In the preceding 12 months, a number of DC's titles had been transformed to 100-page super spectaculars with all new lead stories and classic reprints as backups. Again, we'll refer you to our earlier episode, 100 Pages.
Yes.
JLA had been one of those books, and as a result, was now only being published bi-monthly. Julie and I realised that if we were to do our usual two-part crossover, we would be using up fully a third of the book's yearly output, and that was just too much. Instead, we opted to go in the opposite direction from the huge blockbusters of the 2 years before and try a smaller, more personal story instead. I'd always been a fan of the Golden Age Sandman, and I'd always wondered why he'd been put back into his double-breasted Man of Mystery gas mask outfit when he was revived, instead of the more traditional purple and yellow superhero costume he'd worn in the latter days of the 40s. This would make the perfect place to find out. Thus was born the Creature in the Velvet Cage, a character now more familiarly known as Sand, the sometimes leader of the contemporary Justice Society. And that story was to mark the last of my JLA-JSA crossover efforts, at least as a writer. Several years later, as editor, I oversaw crossovers that fitted the Justice League and Justice Society against the New Gods and the Secret Society of Supervillains, among many others. Yes, thank you, Len. We'll get back to those before too long.
Good.
So after that little comment or contribution from the writer of the story, we should now probably look at the contemporary correspondence.
We certainly shall. Let's zoom ahead to Justice League of America, issue 115, the JLA mailroom. And the first letter says,
Dear Editor, I'm angry. Len Wein's The Creature in the Velvet Cage in JLA 113 was a well-written story filled with action-packed battles and some deep soul-searching for one Wesley Dodds. Sandman, in his green suit and yellow mask, was never more human, and Len Wein used the story to explain the so-long unexplained costume changes of the grainy gladiator. The sandy monster idea was a clever one, but must all of your villains be Dick Dillon's amorphous gargantuans? Dick Dillon's amorphous gargantuans.
Supported menswear.
Yep, I loaded them in at King Tut's last week, I'm just kidding. The wedding scene was a bit overdone, but those muscle-bound Neanderthals were nicely handled. That's obviously the beach bodybuilders. I'm angry! Is this your idea of a JLA-JSA story? Where is the ceremony and the pomp that made these mergers so special in the past? This lack of ceremony is largely out of Len Wein's hands, though. Justice League's a bi-monthly now, and giving two issues to a JLA-JSA team-up, deja vu listeners, leaves only four other issues of the year. I say, so what? This convention of heroes usually brings out the best in your writers and artists. So why is Len Wein writing a one-issue adventure? That is why I'm angry. Don't destroy a long-standing comics tradition. And that very grumpy missive is from David Dash, Brooklyn, New York.
And Bob Rozakis responds, well, dashing Dave, you may be angry, but our next correspondent found JLA 113 a tasty morsel. And the next letter says, dear editor, after reading JLA 113, I can safely say it left both a sweet and a bitter taste in my mouth. That sweet taste. First, the Dylan Giordano art. Dylan's pencils improve with every issue. And as for Giordano, there's no inker in the comics field that does a job like this guy. Fantastic. The second sweet taste was the adventure taking place in one issue instead of two. And oh, that nice sweet plot by Len Wein was utterly sensational. But that bitter taste. The way the Justice League just happened to visit Earth 2 while the Justice Society was locked in mortal combat with the Horned Owl Gang, good name, was stretching probability a bit. And how did Earth 2's Wonder Woman know about her counterpart's adventures on Earth 1? And that's from Don Secris, St. Louis, Missouri.
Yep. Steve, Caitlin, we're going to send you around to Don's house to have a word with him. See if you can find his house. Anyway, editor response to that one reads, maybe she read about it in the Amazon Times. Seriously, the JLA and JSA members are in frequent contact, and it's more than likely that news of Diana Prince regaining her powers would be passed on to her counterpart. Yeah, that's reasonable.
Fair enough, yes.
I like the idea of them all, you know, because they've got their transmatter cubes and all that now, being in regular contact.
Yeah.
Maybe helping each other out more casually than we ever really...
Maybe sending each other newsletters.
Yeah.
Weekly updates.
Emails.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maybe whoever's on monitor duty at the JLA satellite will check in Indeed. With Dr. Fate or something. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the next letter. Dear editor, what can I say? Terrific trio of Wein, Dylan and Giordano has done it again. The Creature in the Velvet Cage stays in line with the top quality expected in the JLA-JSA team-ups. There is no explanation needed for the Justice Leaguers appearing on Earth 2. All JLA fans know they used the dimensional transmitter introduced in JLA 107, and Len has not forgotten that the JSA members also had their share of kid proteges. We've already seen that Robin has replaced his mentor there, and now we find out about another, Sandy Hawkins. Not since the days of Simon and Kirby has the Sandman been so strange and mysterious. Len has captured the very essence of the grainy gladiator. In the last two pages, the Sandman's tormented apology and the Batman's comment were the perfect ending to a story that will surely go down in the annals of DC history. And that's from Warren Morrison, Commerce, Texas. Warren Morrison? Did Warren Ellis and Grant team up and go back in time and write a letter?
May have done.
Editorial response.
And now for the dissenting opinion from the Brooklyn bomber, Joe Peluso.
Right, Peter's now going to do this in a Brooklyn accent.
No, he's not. Dear editor, to say I was disappointed with JLA 113 would be an understatement.
Gasp.
The Creature in the Velvet Cage was Len Wein's worst JLA script. Now that's a strong statement from a Len Wein fan, but a writer can't expect kudos for everything he writes. What made the story so unlike other JLA epics was an extreme lack of suspense, an uninspired plot and only four Justice Society members. The entire tale was trite and uneventful. The blast turns hero into monster bit has been done before, and the fact that only one issue was allotted for the annual team-up should have been grounds to forget it this year.
Oh my goodness.
That's Joe Peluso, yes, Brooklyn, New York.
Joe, I think we probably disagree with you there. I can understand where he's coming from. I think suspending the whole thing for a year would have been very silly.
Yeah.
Also, one of the others sort of said, you know, talked about, you know, understanding why they didn't make it a multiple part story. And I think if you're going to have a big universe harming crossover thing every year, which features loads of other heroes, and it's nice to just do something a bit intimate for a
change. Very personal story. Scale. Yeah, without a doubt.
And it worked very well. And I think most of the heroes involved got a chance to shine. Batman didn't get too much to do, but it got the last word, so it balances out.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
No Red Tornado.
Thank goodness for that. But he will. I think he will be back soon.
He will be.
Anyway, listeners, we've gone on quite long enough with all our thoughts on the 1974 JLA JSA story.
And all these guys need to get their last buses home.
I know.
So thank you everyone for coming.
Yes. Thanks once again to everyone for helping us out with their extra voices. With a cast of thousands, one like this, it's nice to have some other folk to help out and take the weight off. And it's a matter of the esteem in which I hold them that I asked Brandon to voice Superman and Shag to voice Our Man, so that, because I would do them normally. So
yes,
thanks so much for that, guys. Thanks to Max and Rich from the Weird Warriors podcast for doing Elongating Man and Sandman for the third year in a row as far as JLA JSA crossovers.
Yep.
Thanks to Steve for voicing Batman. Thanks to Christine for voicing Wonder Woman. Thanks to our pal Ross for voicing The Flash, another string to his bow.
Yep.
Be sure to check out Ross's ongoing Stop Let's Team Up podcast. He's at some really interesting stuff in his Legion coverage at the moment, and his Sandman stuff is getting very interesting as well. And thanks once again to our bud Logan McFarlane, now having voiced his fourth teen DC superhero.
Oh, yeah.
So Speedy, Superboy, Captain Marvel Jr., and now Sandy. Who's left? When's Wonder Girl going to turn up? We've got anything planned with Aqualad anytime soon? I don't know. Gavin, of course, returning as Green Lantern also for the third JLA JSA crossover.
Indeed,
in the row.
Yes.
At the point of recording, we don't have Gav's lines. We're hoping that you'll get them in time. God bless you, Gav. And to our pal Chuck Loridans as Patrick, because Peter forgot Green Arrow wasn't in this story, and asked Chuck if he'd do it. And Chuck was like, yeah. And he went, oh, hang on, he's not. So we had to get Chuck to do something. And of course, a huge thank you to long-time listener Caitlin Higgins for providing her first vocal contribution to the podcast, hopefully the first of many.
Thank you, one and all. And as usual, we'll put links to the various podcasts and projects that all these wonderful, talented people are involved in. Now, if you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at theearth2podcast@gmail.com and let us know what you think of this episode, or what you think about the story, what you think of the amazing vocal performances. You can also follow us on social media, because David's got some amazing bonus material for this.
You have.
And indeed, every episode. On Facebook and Instagram, we're at TheEarth2Podcast, and on Twitter, we're at podcast_earth2, and it's the number 2 for all of our social media.
If you've enjoyed this episode and any others, please feel free to go to wherever it is you receive your podcast and leave us a positive review. That'd be dandy. If you'd like to go even further and go to our coffee page and buy Peter the price of a beverage, that'd be even more lovely, wouldn't it?
Yes.
I think so.
That would be Bino. Hey.
If you insist, on that bombshell.
On that bombshell. I've been Peter.
I've been David. Everyone else has been everyone else, and we'll see you soon on
The Earth 2 Podcast.
Transmatter Cube activated. Return coordinates set for Earth Prime.